Oh, let's see. What am I doing here? Why can't I hear me, Pam? Huh. I cannot hear me. I wonder why. All right. Well, I guess I'm not going to hear me today. Let's see. I'm playing with... Let's play with the jacks. Okay. Oh, there we go. Bad jack. Tells me that Nick was in... Owner Nick was in here playing with things. Well, anyway, welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens, below the line, with all those movers and shakers, those film and TV makers, those Oscar winners and losers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, VFX gurus, sound editors, sound mixers, composers, choreographers, stunt coordinators, and fight choreographers. You name it, we talk to them. And of course, we just wrapped up. Oscars awards season is done. Ah, but a new one starts now. Emmy campaign. Emmy campaign is starting for Emmy Awards. So I'm looking forward to that. Been catching up on quite a few binge-worthy series out there. You all know the Silo I am obsessed with. So that, of course, will be hot in the running for the upcoming Emmy season. And a bunch of other fun things in there as well. But we'll talk about them later on as we dive into the Emmy contenders. But today's show, very happy. Number one, we're in the studio today, in case you were wondering. And if you're listening, if you go over to the Adrenaline Radio Facebook page, you'll see it live streaming on this stupid Mevo camera thing that I can't stand. But you will see on the tablescape an adorable, number one, you will see the brand new Dinosaur Valley Girls re-release in Blu-ray. So for all of you cult followers who love films like this, you definitely want to pick this up because it is hilarious. You know, it's caveman, it's dinosaurs, it's Dinosaur Valley Girls. But a brand new Blu-ray that is out this Friday, actually tomorrow. Tomorrow is March 4th. It's already on digital platforms. It is a film I fell in love with back in October at the Animationist Film Festival, Ghost Cat and Zoo. Tomorrow, you can pick this up on Blu-ray. It's from G-Kids. It is just so much fun. And this was already a series, a Japanese anime series. And a film was made. And the filmmaker is just absolutely wonderful. I interviewed her. Her interview is actually translated and up on my website. Of course, it was done in Japanese. But now, this particular, the Blu-ray... let me just double check. I'm reading my notes here to make sure I give you the correct information. I think this one has dubbing on it in English. I actually watched it with subtitles. But it is a fun, fun movie. The animation is absolutely enchanting. And, you want to check it out. Pick up a copy. It's wonderful. Wonderful. Yoko Kuno is one of the directors of the film. This is her featured directorial debut, along with Nobuhiro Yamashita, who directed Linda, Linda, Linda. But it's beautiful. The animation, it's a delight. But watching the adventures of Ghost Cat Anzu... Let your kids watch it and see what they do to your house. That's all I'm going to say. But now, We could talk a little about the Oscars. I thought they were very lackluster. The opening number by Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande was absolutely beautiful. I love the James Bond tribute. Of course, this marks the end of an era after the Broccoli family has now turned over creative control to Amazon, who I think are just going to merchandise the hell out of the franchise and turn it into something that is not the James Bond franchise that we know and love. But it was a lovely tribute to honor the James Bond legacy, a musical tribute with some of the best known songs. I don't know what the performer Lisa was trying to do with Paul McCartney's incredible Live and Let Die theme, but it was horrific. Doja Cat, who performed Diamonds Are Forever, was fabulous. And I forget who the third performer was who did Skyfall, which was amazing. It was a beautiful tribute. I would have liked to have seen a few James Bonds walk out there. But, it was a nice touch. They did a big build up to, a surprise reunion, 35 years in the making, coming in the broadcast. Okay, their surprise reunion, 35 years in the making, was to announce the Best Picture winner, which was Anora, not my pick, but, and the surprise reunion, no big surprise as far as I'm concerned, Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan celebrating When Harry Met Sally 35 years later. It would have been a great surprise. Number one, you have to remember that there was already a 30th reunion of them at TCM Film Festival a few years ago for When Harry Met Sally, and they were both there. But most recently, we've been flooded with the Super Bowl commercial that is now everywhere post-Super Bowl, of Meg and Billy as Harry and Sally recreating the I'll Have What She's Having deli scene as an advertisement for Hellman's/Best Foods mayonnaise. So since we've been peppered with them, it's not like this was any kind of surprise reunion. That was a little miffing. And of course, the In Memoriam, smart move they made by not having a soloist singing. Camera was not panning down to a piano or a singer. We were not distracted. There was a beautiful chorale music of Mozart's Lacrimosa and the Academy Orchestra. The tribute was very nice, but again, a ton of people omitted, and we're talking big names that were omitted. Mitzi Gaynor, James Darren, Eleanor Coppola, not to mention Michelle Trachtenberg, who, granted, has a younger demographic than some people, but she passed away 3 days before Gene Hackman, and Gene Hackman was included, but not Michelle. Tony Roberts was not included. John Ashton from the Beverly Hills Cop franchise. He was left out. So if you've been reading, Blue Sky, Facebook, Twitter/X, Threads even, there's a lot of discourse about who once again was omitted. And all I can say, I have said this over the years, many, 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 many people have said this, especially the fans of TCM. TCM does such a wonderful job with In Memoriams. Just contract with TCM and let them do your In Memoriam. It will be current. It will be beautiful. It will be poignant. And people will not be left out. And by by the Academy posting things, you can go to our website and you can see everybody who passed away. That's not the point. How do you have an In Memoriam and not include Mitzi Gaynor and James Darren? Or John Ashton? How do you do that? I don't know. But we'll see what happens next year. As for the winners, my fave of the year of the nominees, Conclave, yes, picked up best adapted screenplay. And that was it. Of course, I will say that Isabella Rossellini looked beautiful in a blue velvet design gown, which was made in tribute to David Lynch. And she was in his films, specifically Blue Velvet. And a lovely touch, she was wearing her mother's diamond and pearl earrings that her mother, Ingrid Bergman, wore when she won the Academy Award, her second Academy Award, some years ago. So, nice little touches like that. But we're going to move on into the new year and talk about moving on. Today, I'm very excited. Joining me live, somewhere around the midpoint of the show, is writer-director Tiffany Kim Stevens to talk about her new film, Trigger Happy. It's a doozy. It is wicked. It is wild. It's genre bending and melding. I absolutely love it. And I think you will too. But Tiffany will be joining me live. But first, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with director Dito Montiel. You may know Dito's work from A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints that he did a number of years ago. He wrote the book and then he adapted it into a film. This time, the film Riff Raff. It is written by playwright John Polono, who adapted it for this film. It boasts an amazing cast: Ed Harris, Jennifer Coolidge, Gabrielle Union, Miles J. Harvey, Lewis Pullman, one of my faves, Bill Murray, Pete Davidson. And it's basically the story of Vincent. Vincent is played by Ed Harris. He's an ex-criminal who just wants a normal, peaceful life. He and his wife, Sandy, played by Gabrielle Union, have built a loving family with their son, DJ, who is played by Miles Harvey. And they're spending New Year's at their cabin up in the woods before DJ goes off to college. However, in the middle of the night, who shows up but Vincent's son, kind of disowned son, Rocco, who is just marvelously portrayed by Lewis Pullman, and his pregnant girlfriend, Marina, plus Vincent's ex-wife, Ruth, who I'm talking a comedy star performance here from Jennifer Coolidge as Ruth. So it turns into a total dysfunctional family free-for-all. But adding to the mix, there are two gangsters, Lefty and Lonnie. Lefty, of course, played by Bill Murray. Lonnie played by Pete Davidson. Lonnie is Lefty's son. And they're hot on the trail of Vincent's family, actually Rocco. But Lefty's got a grudge and a bone to pick with Vincent. So it's multi-generational. It is hilarious. It is dark comedy. It is dysfunctional family. And it is so much fun. And it is out right now in theaters. I encourage you to run, don't walk, to this one. Cinematographer is Xavier Grobet, who has done quite a bit of the White Lotus TV series. Editor is Tim Strito, who does a wonderful job as we have looks backward with Rocco's retelling of how the heck he ended up at his dad's house in the middle of the night. And it's just so much fun. Score by Adam Taylor. So, and it was shot in Jersey. So, take a listen to my exclusive interview with Dito Montiel talking about the dark comedy, dark and dysfunctional comedy, Riff Raff. Yeah, Pam has to stop typing on her cell phone. Okay.
I love that it even sounds like a landline. I'm so happy to hear a landline. It's been a while.
I wouldn't trade my landline for anything, Dito.
I love it. I'm here for it.
I'm so glad. Well, one thing I'm here for is to tell you how wonderful and how much fun I had watching Riff Raff.
Oh, thanks, yeah. Just a kooky bunch of people.
Well, you know, it's the kooky bunch of dysfunctional family members and mobs and crime and, gee, it warms this Philly girl's heart, let me tell you.
Okay, yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on between these people.
Oh, my.
Issues.
I mean, it's actually, it's a great character study of each of these individuals. And that's something that you really let breathe in this film is nobody is a cookie cutter. Everybody has depth and three-dimensionality to them. And I really appreciate that you did that. And with this great cast, to really let them soar so that we feel we know these people intimately. And I love how you have done that and achieved that, you know.
Thanks, yeah. I mean, you know, it's always, you know, a trip, you know, because, you know, I remember, like, reading it and, you know, like, I remember thinking, okay, yeah, sure, there's definitely some funny stuff, but I try to read it as if I'm in the family and they don't think it's very funny, you know.
Yeah.
So I had this picture, you know, the first, you know, I thought of Ruth first because it's hard not to, you
mm-hmm.
know, and kind of thought of my sister Dee Dee, who's kind of somewhere between Jennifer Coolidge and Fran Lebowitz. That's a possibility on Earth. And I just was thinking, I thought of a scene that didn't exist in the movie at the time, just as a character thing, you know, like, oh, you know, I'd love to do something where she's looking at all that she can't have, you know, all
mm-hmm.
that Sandy has that she can't have. And you know, and then we had 15 minutes before lunch one day, and I'm like, oh, you know, can we just go look at her all her expensive cosmetics, you know? And it was just a character thing. Like Nick, I don't know if we'll use this, but you know, and of course Jennifer decides to steal everything in there, which is her bag of tricks that she brings. But it's trying to find some sort of grounded thing to each of the people so that, you know, none of us are portraying, you know, characters to say, you know. So, I mean, they're characters for sure, but find some grounding to them, you know.
The bathroom scene, on the one hand, I was laughing myself silly, because I have known people that will do that and go into somebody's bathroom or boudoir and try out the products. And then next time you walk in there, well, where's this? Where's my perfume? Where's my brush? So I got a chuckle out of that. But at the same time, Jennifer captures this so beautifully, the almost wistfulness or the sense of entitlement that this should be mine. This should be mine. And it wasn't. So it's very, there's a great poignancy there. And I love how you work with your DP, with Xavier, on the visual grammar to capture that, because we have the mirror there and she's looking in the mirror as she's doing this. So we get that great split personality kind of metaphor happening. And it's so beautifully done from performance to lensing. I just love that scene.
Yeah, you know, it's weird because I had seen White Lotus like the rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
Which was my introduction to Jennifer Coolidge, you know. And Javier Grover, who shot that, I remember thinking, oh, and then I looked him up and he did Before Night Falls, which is such a beautiful film in a different way, in a, such a, you know. And I was that stalker who found him on Facebook. And I wrote him. And I said, hey, man, you're really good. And I'm doing this crazy movie. And lucky enough, he said, okay, here's my number. Give me a call. But I felt in really good hands because he took the movie. I think sort of like we tried very hard to not, well, not tried, but, you know, didn't worry too much about the humor, per se. I mean, you know, I thought White Lotus, of course, such a well-shot and worked film, TV show, whatever. But you know, like, we try to be members of the family, you know, or whatever. So, you know, it allows that stuff. But, yeah, you're in good hands with someone like him, you know.
Well, and I love the visual grammar and the way that the camera does. We're not flies on the wall. You have movement within each scene. When we've got Lefty and Lonnie, and they're in Vincent's living house that he lives in, the camera is going around the living room. We're seeing different aspects, just as you would do if you were in the house or walking in for the first time, checking it out. And you do this everywhere. You do it in Vincent and Sandy's, their country house up in the mountains. You do it in Vincent's house. You do it in the smaller, intimate settings, such as the restaurant or even the bar scene, as Rocco is relating how he met Marina and giving us the whole backstory on his relationship with Johnny, which is not a good one.
Yeah, it doesn't work out too well, yeah.
But I love how the two of you and Xavier have worked together to develop the visual grammar to give us this intimate, personal feeling. Was there anything in particular that the two of you came up with as a guiding principle for how you wanted the camera to play out?
You know, it's funny because, you know, like, we do this thing that I think is a really great tool, especially if you're doing a smaller film, you know, or any kind of film, you know, is I don't really believe in storyboards, well, because I'm really terrible at drawing, you know, but also it's like a dream that can't come true in independent film. Like, yeah, okay, I'm going to build a window there. Good luck, you know? So the way we like to work it, or I like to work it at least, is we find a location, and just like an actor, it tells me what they're going to do with this scene, you know? So we, and then what we do is we go to the location and we film it on an iPhone, or Javier might bring his camera, or however, you know, and we act it out. It's the worst acting you've ever seen in your life. We all hold the script, and it's me and the AD and the DP are there, and the production designer and whoever, you know, and we act out the scenes because then we've lived them, you know, and sometimes it's like a living storyboard in the sense that I've lived it now, and I realized, oh my God, that was 4 pages of sitting down. Maybe you want to get up, you know. So it's little things like that, but as far as emotionally, there's always a plan. The only plan I've ever really had with a lot of things, when you're getting into something that has to do hopefully deeper than just a surface type thing, which that's a different type of movie, you know,
mm-hmm.
is I try, I don't know what this means on paper, but to experience the film as if it's happening, right?
Yeah.
There's a great documentary about Midnight Cowboy that I guess they were cutting that movie for years and they couldn't figure it out. And they called up Waldo Salt, the writer, and he said, you keep doing flashbacks. They're not flashbacks. They're happening in real time. They're happening. When that character is, it's happening, you know? It's kind of like if you're in a traumatic or weird situation and you're remembering something, it's happening for you in that moment, right? I mean, this is weird voodoo stuff, but so I try to film as if things are happening in that moment. So if you're in the room, you're in there. This is not, you know, we don't do a dissolve into your memory. We're gone. And if the audience is lost for a few seconds or a few minutes, that's okay. They'll figure it out, or they won't. Just enjoy it, you know? So try emotionally. I try emotionally to experience what's happening, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes that helps. When if you have a great cinematographer with you, all this weird talk, they know how to translate it. Because I don't with storyboards, but I felt in pretty good hands with a guy like him, certainly after seeing Before Night Falls and White Lotus. It seemed like the perfect combination to be shooting this one, you know?
Well, you definitely, it's very grounded. I wasn't ever confused. As you're going back and forth, we've got essentially a couple storylines that are happening. We've got Lefty and Lonnie happening on the one hand, and then we've got Vincent and his whole extended family on the other hand. And this is where your editing is so key here, because it seamlessly goes back and forth and integrates. And when Rocco is telling us about his misadventures that led him to showing up at Dad's house in the middle of the night, it's seamless. It is seamless. And it feels very, it's happening right now, as you said. As Rocco is relaying this, the incidents that led to that moment, it was very much in the here and now. And I love that. You didn't go with the dissolves or sepia tone for a memory or anything like that. It was very, very kinetic, and I loved how you executed that.
Thanks. Yeah, that's thanks to the documentary about World of Salt. I thought that was just such an interesting thought that don't worry about it. It's happening. You know, experience it with the actor or the character or whatever, you know.
What was it about this script, because you got this first as a play from John. What was it about this that spoke to you and made you sit up and go, I got to make this into a movie?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed that, you know, like this, like I was saying, like this sort of, I remember, you know, like, of course I was, you know, I thought it was funny, you know, but I thought like, oh, like I really love DJ, you know? And then I remember thinking, you know, just I write my notes in real time, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, wait, what's going on here? You know, and then I get to 10 pages later, I'm like, okay, I think I know what's going on, you know. I was intrigued in that sense, and I thought, oh wow, it isn't often, at least from what I've read or written, that, you know, how most films are, okay, there's a lead, and then he falls in love,
mm-hmm.
and then they have a scene, and then there's a bad guy or a bad woman somewhere, and then a couple of day players, you know? This felt like everybody that comes in takes over for a while, and I thought, how fun, like, I don't usually get to do that. And I mean, even the smaller roles, like P.J. Byrne, and they play the scene of the neighbors, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, and I know the actor P.J. Byrne, and I said, oh my God, P.J. is gonna kill this scene, like, it'll be so fun. And I called him up, and I was like, hey, P.J., man, like, listen, we're shooting a movie in New Jersey, you have to fly yourself in, it's only one scene, but it's with Bill Murray and Pete Davidson and this incredible actress in New York. And he said, I'll be there, you know. So what excited me was I felt like nobody's just playing, you know, the token booth clerk. Although I always care about those roles too, everything, you know. But I felt like when Sandy comes in, it's her movie. When Emanuela comes in, it's her movie. When it's DJ, he's clearly in and out of this thing, you know. So it felt like a true ensemble, which is so exciting if you mm-hmm. can put a bunch of great actors together. So that was probably what excited me most. You know, it was a really fun story that I thought can be real, and wow, what a, you know, I'm a real fan of acting, so I thought this will be fun to work with a bunch of good actors in it.
Last question. Well, I have to ask you then about putting together this amazing cast. Not only are the actors amazing, but they are so appropriately cast. So talk to me about about casting Riff Raff. This could not have been easy.
I mean, but you know, again, like, you know, I mean, the thing is, if you're coming to the set of my films, for better or worse, you're not coming for a payday, you know? So you want to be there. And these, you know, so I know, you know, to people, you know, oh, how is this an independent movie with all these people in it? Well, it was. It is, you know? They show up. So Jennifer Coolidge was the first person to come on. And the good news about that is, besides me, it seems like the whole world seems to love her. So then I had Ed Harris's email from being an advisor of mine at Sundance Labs. I hit him up and he read it and said, I love Jennifer Coolidge and I think this is fun. So it was a combination of, you know, just luck and just hitting people up and a domino effect, again, that I think it starts with the writing, you know, and if someone thinks they can really have a role as opposed to just playing the girlfriend or the wife or the next door, you know, whatever. I think that was the magic card to this one, you know.
You have woven a spell over me with Riff Raff, Dito. It is so much fun. I definitely am going to see this again because I'm in love with the characters and the story and the whole meld. And terrific, terrific job.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Dito, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me this morning. Hopefully we'll chat again in the future.
We will. Okay, thank you.
And that was director Dito Montiel talking about Riff Raff in theaters now. Go see it. Go see it. Go see it. I think you'll have a lot of fun. watching it. Now, we're just waiting for Tiffany Kim Stevens to give us a call so we can talk about Trigger Happy. But I did want to make another Oscar mention here. Diane Warren. We all love Diane Warren. Her 16th nomination, her 16th loss. And I do have to say, out of the original songs that were nominated, her song, The Journey, for the incredible Tyler Perry movie, 6888. For my money, musically, emotionally, the lyrics of the song, that should have been the best original song winner. But we know if there's nothing that we are not sure that we have any doubts about is that Diane will be back in the future with more songs undoubtedly to get nominated for a best original song. Heartbreaking. And despite George Pinocchio's good luck annual, you know, every time Diane is nominated, you know, she says George is a good luck charm. I'm wondering if George is a good luck charm because she still hasn't won. And he always brings her a little gift to the red carpet whenever she's nominated. And it was very cute. They have such a wonderful friendship. It was very cute to see that inside his tuxedo jacket was a purple heart that was sewn in with her initials. Just adorable. And, of course, who didn't love June Squibb last night? June Squibb, she looked radiant, fabulous, and she's 95 years old. And I still think the woman deserves a stunt nomination because of she did all of her own stunts in Thelma. So, all right, let's see. Pam, let's take a short break while I try and find out where our director is. And we will be back momentarily.
Babes, what are you doing?
What? I'm just mowing the lawn.
No, it's blazing hot and dry out here. Don't you remember? Smokey Bear says,
avoid using power equipment when it's windy or dry.
Where'd you learn this?
Oh, it's on
SmokeyBear.com with many other wildfire prevention tips.
Right. Thanks, Honey Bear.
Because remember, only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
You know, it's amazing when I say take a break because I have to try and find a publicist. You never give me much time, Pam. Publicist Karen is trying to track her down. All right. Well, while Karen's trying to track down this director and find out where she is, let me just tell you what's coming up the rest of the month. Next week, very excited for you to hear. I just did the interview on Friday with the wonderful Adam Egoyan. Adam Egoyan I love this man. His films, Remember, starring Martin Landau, Chloe with Amanda Seyfried, Devil's Knot, The Captive, phenomenal films. And Adam and I, we were on a roll there for quite a while, chatting, sitting down and chatting about each one of these films. And now he's back with Seven Veils, which blew my mind. It stars Amanda Seyfried, and we really dug in to the making of Seven Veils. He's working again with his cinematographer, Paul Cerosi. And of course, Michael Dana does the score for him. When does Michael Dana not score an Atom Egoyan film? But it's, he actually, what he did, he is obsessed with the story of Salome. That story goes back to the Bible. It's very seductive. And he was a stage director and did versions of this over the past 30 years. And then they were remounting, the Canadian Opera Company was remounting Salome for a new stage production in 2023. So Adam got this great idea. Let's make a film around that production. So using the opera company, the singers, so we're seeing that unfold, and we've got a story happening behind it that he wrote. Just amazing. So I can't wait for you to hear that interview next week. Ah, and we have found our director. Okay, Pam's nodding her head. All right, so let me bring her live now. Are you there, Tiffany?
Hi, I'm here. How's it going?
It's going, it's going. Yay, we found you, we found you. And here to talk
about... I'm glad to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you after watching Trigger Happy.
Thank you so much for taking the time to watch it. I really appreciate it.
Tiffany, it is so funny. I love what you've done in terms of the story, working with your co-writer, Daniel Moya. Just briefly, tell everybody what this story is.
Story is set a 50s inspired world where gender roles are reversed, and it is about a repressed husband who attempts to murder his breadwinning wife for life insurance. It's a dark comedy satire.
Yes, it is. And what you have done, I love the 1950s, but you've also modernized it with present-day elements, but you always take us back to, there's a great little corner store there, you know, Kent's store, and Kent has Kent products, and he has specials, 35-cent sandwich specials, and it's so funny as you see all this, and we look into the home of George, our husband who wants to escape to the Bahamas and kill his wife and collect the insurance money so he can go to the Bahamas. We go to their house. The kitchen is so 1950s. You've got the Mixmaster sitting there on the counter, and it's blue, and you have a matching Robin's Egg blue refrigerator. And you incorporate all of this really cool vintage stuff, but you still have a modern flavor to it. So, you know, kudos to your production designer, Dorothy Zhu, as well as your set dresser, and in tracking down all of these items that pop up. And, you know, you set this so that the breadwinner, Annie, you know, she's a wannabe actress. And she auditions to sell sponges. A wow sponge. Kind of like Lucille Ball. Invite me to Vegemin, actually. And it just takes off from there, and it is just one thing after another. This is so well crafted, Tiffany, in terms of your characters, in terms of turning gender roles on their head. How challenging was it to, once you had this idea, how challenging was it to give so much depth and life to each of your characters?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for all of that. I really appreciate how like meticulous you were watching the movie, and you picked up on all these like color nuances, and yes, the world building and how the reality is super uncanny. But in terms of bringing these characters to life, I mean, Annie and George are my parents, and Annie is my father, and George is my mother. And I really wanted to give my father a feminine voice and my mother a masculine voice, and being able to take them as seeds of inspiration, bringing them to life in these really entertaining, comical, yet deeply introspective and disturbing ways was fascinating. And then also working, obviously, with Daniel to take that seed and make it the tree that it is today. But yeah, my parents were the original seed.
Oh, my God. And then we have their besties. We've got Gemma and Mikey, and they're just, it's like, maybe Mikey is not a bestie, because everybody's trying to avoid him at all costs. And then Kent, I love the character of Kent, our little store owner. And the fact that he's black, which you typically would not have found in a neighborhood such as this back in the 1950s. So you're turning that on its head as well. And, you know, at every turn, you're giving us depth and things to think about. So who were your inspirations for Gemma and Mikey and Kent?
Well, Gemma and Mikey the inspirations for them were my parents' best friends. had very scandalous affairs growing up, as I was sort of soaking it all in. And, well, Kent, we went with a very traditional hero's, well, it's really a villain's journey. Every character in this movie is a villain. A villain's journey structure. And Kent needed to represent the audience, the chorus, so to say, with like Greek tragic terms.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed a character that was just pure and good and who saw the good in people. And we wanted him to be that corner, you know, a stable corner for the audience to always relate through and see through. And he was that. He was the audience. He represents the viewer.
And he has such a meticulous, adorable little store. I can't tell you how much I love the detail in that store, especially the radio up on the top shelf behind the cash register. But for the fact that the one in my parents' bedroom since the 1950s was pink, a beautiful, bright pink, it's the same radio. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And to my knowledge, that even though both my parents have passed, my brother owns the house. I think that radio is still sitting there on the headboard of the bed.
Incredible. That is such a beautiful radio.
Oh, my. Isn't it? But, yeah, that's the only difference. So it's like I'm looking at that from the viewpoint of authenticity and how much you did to really, you know, make us feel that 1950s vibe, including George's billboard dream as he walks by this billboard every day on his way to work in his unfulfilling, miserable job in a restaurant. And it's a beautiful, beautiful. Those are the kind of postcards that were very prevalent in the 40s and 50s. And it's fantastic to see that. That you thought that much about the elements of this film, Tiffany. I really appreciate that. And that's what really makes this, brings so much of the fun to life here. And it's also where your DP, Sini Bryan, comes into play here. Talk to me about developing your visual grammar, because you have distinct visual grammar happening here to shoot this. And it's not as traditional as people might think. So talk to me about working with Sini and designing that visual grammar.
Yeah. So, well, I've worked with, her name's Shawnee. I've worked with Shawnee since 2020. And her and I have just this really almost telepathic understanding of art and the way she innovates. And what she's really good at doing is taking what I see in the sense of like, hey, I want to evoke this specific feeling. And then she can translate that into that's what this shot means, that's what this lens means, and that's what this lighting means. So I say the art and she turns it into the technical. And I think that's something that work so well for us in terms of our workflow. But I remember very distinctly when we were in pre-production and sort of shot listing out together, we really wanted to add a sense of voyeurism to the camera work, because we did not want the audience to be part of this film. We wanted them to witness this film, because ultimately it's a cautionary tale. It's a depiction of people, of villainous people living very miserable lives, and it's absurd. And the entertainment factor is the dark comedy of it all. But ultimately, you know, we wanted to keep the camera at a very, at a distance where they could watch, where the audience could watch everything going down without actually feeling like they are the characters or are there. So one of the distinct moments I remember is when Annie finds a gas leak. We established earlier on that George, you know, and I'm spoilers alert, but we established earlier on that George turned up the gas, turned up the carbon monoxide in the house. And the camera stays outside in the driveway because the audience already knows what Annie's about to walk into. And so we have that like long take where she goes in, we see her go past the window and she comes back out. And so moments like that, with creating that third party voyeur experience, was a huge conversation with Shawnee throughout the entire process of,
you know, and of course,
the length. Yeah.
And of course you've got multiple scenes in George and Annie's house where the camera is outside. But you've got the beautiful windows in the front and the drapes are open. So we're the neighbors. We're out on the sidewalk. We can see what's going on in there. Thank goodness.
Yes.
Thank goodness nobody was walking around naked, but okay.
Yes.
We can see, you know, her Annie choking and holding her nose, which I thought was really cute, her holding her nose because it smelled. But it just all those little details. You didn't shirk away, but I love the camera work for that, because then we also go to something like the airfield where George and Annie are going to go skydiving. Then George decides he's not going skydiving, but Annie's says, all right, I'm going to do it. She doesn't want to do it, but she's going to do it. And you go much wider. We really get the wide open spaces on the one side, where the planes are, where she's going to go, and she's going to go up in this small two-seater. But then on the right, we've got the closed, darker environment where George is, like, taking safety almost. That, like, he has an idea of what might happen or could happen, and we're just watching it all. But I like how the camera goes wider in those particular sequences. So we really get a different perspective. You know, is there freedom? Metaphorically, is George seeing freedom with the blue sky out there in the airport? So you give us a lot to think about there.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad you're picking up on all of this, because it's all very intentional.
And, you know, I will tell you, one of my favorite scenes in the film, though, is the birthday party scene where George...
Iconic.
Oh, my God. Well, and what I love about that is that Jacob Wysocki is the birthday boy, the birthday man. And
yes,
I adore Jacob. I interviewed him for his first few films. We did sit-downs for Fat Kid Rules the World, for Terry. And he had just turned, I can't remember if it was for Terry or for Fat Kids, he had just turned 21. And the weekend after we did our interview, he was going to Vegas for the very first time to gamble. So, So to see him playing a birthday, you know, birthday boy here with the hat and everything was really cute. But those I love little things like that in films. I love those little touchstones. And the birthday party scene, it's like so, like cheap Chuck E. Cheese. Just adorable. You can't help but laugh at it. Especially you made them do a dance. You have the employees doing a dance. They're not just singing. They're doing a dance. Tiffany.
Yes.
You are cruel. Cruel. A cruel taskmaster.
Well, it was really, we needed a musical spectacle in there. Because first of all, for just like technical reasons, we needed to break up the second act. Because it was just getting a bit of a lull. And I'm like, all right, how can we add in the wow factor into the second act? And then we talked about, you know, maybe doing another attempted murder and all these other things. And I'm like, no. Let's do a classic all-American birthday Cheesecake Factory Chuck E. Cheese-esque dance. Let's really lean into that. And everyone was like, absolutely brilliant. So funny, especially to have George, who just does not enjoy life, do this crazy dance that celebrates life. And it's just going to be a visual spectacle and just a really fun way to make people laugh.
And the birthday man loved it.
He loved it.
I mean, George and his two co-employees looked like they were going to die. The one, she's got a smile plastered on her face like Jack Nicholson is the Joker, and it doesn't move. And, you know, nobody's liking it. But the birthday man really loved it. And
he loves it. Yeah.
It just, because you also know, seeing him sitting there alone, that he has nobody to spend his birthday with. Which is also it's a nice subtextual element you add, Tiffany, because here you've got George, he's married, he's got a house. He might not be totally happy, but he clearly had, and same thing with Gemma and Mikey. They clearly have more than this birthday man who's all by himself has. They do have people in their lives. And he doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's a nice little subtext that you've got layered in under there. And I really appreciate that and the thought that you put into that. And if you didn't put thought into that, you can now say you did. So,
well, I will tell you that I definitely did, mainly because all these other characters are so ungrateful.
Yeah.
They never express any sense of gratitude. And that's part of the fact that they're all villains. And these villains are now having to perform something for someone who does really need it and does have this sense of gratitude. And so showing that dichotomy just really highlights how awful our main characters are.
Mm-hmm. So now you've got great performances here, fun performances here. You've shot it, and now you go into the editing bay with Carter. How challenging was the edit on this one? Just because of the very nature, number one, comedy is hard to edit, to find those beats. But in a comedy like a darker comedy with some satire in here, that's even harder, I think. So how challenging was the edit of this one?
To be honest, it was actually a consistent blast. Carter is a master storyteller, and that's one of the reasons why I originally wanted to work with him, is because I know that he understands directing and story more than anything. And he's a funny guy. And so working through the edit with him, I mean, he did, you know, the first second cuts, and then I came in and we did, you know, we collabed from there. We were laughing the entire time. We knew the beats that we needed to hit. We also had Daniel on the phone, very easily accessible for moments. Like, we were like, okay, how do you feel about the timing on this?
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, the post-process was not challenging at all, in the sense that it was just very fun. And I love post personally. I thrive in post-production. And being able to really make the movie in post was the best part. And so I to answer your question, Carter is a storyteller and he understands story and he is a funny guy. And so it was a breeze and a blast.
Well, now let me ask you, this begs the question, because you love post, do you think of that while you are directing, while you and Shawnee are, you know, while Shawnee's shooting, while you're blocking things out with your actors, while you're getting performances and locking them down on film, do you think about that post-process and editing in your head while you are actually shooting in order to, number one, save time and money because it's an independent film. It's what I love to call the low budget, no budget, micro budget films that really push the creative boundary of filmmakers. But I'm curious, did you keep in mind the post process and your editing while you were filming? Or did you just go willy-nilly and let Shawnee just shoot everything and 10 coverages and things like that? Which something tells me you did not.
Yeah, we did not. I definitely keep the edit in mind always when I am on set. I see the movie as it's playing out. And as you said, it is a very low-budget movie, so we don't have the luxury to get 10, you know, different setups and all this coverage, to which we probably didn't even need it in the first place. Yeah, we were very adamant and meticulous and intentional about all the specific shots. And yes, I do see the pacing and the edit as we're shooting, definitely.
Now, the icing on the cake here is Peter Lamb's score. You are so judicious in using music in this film. Talk to me about what you were looking for musically from Peter, but also, you know, you don't have a constant score as an undercurrent running through this film. So I'm curious about your mindset and your thought process for keeping that scoring minimal in comparison to other films that we see out there.
Yes. So one of the biggest inspirations for the score was White Lotus, because it's also another satire. And Peter and I were really approaching this in a way that was the opposite of what he was taught at film school, which is approach this in the completely wrong direction. And what that was he came on set. He had the script since day one, you know, like early drafts of the script, so he could develop alongside the characters. And so one thing that we really approached was, instead of going with mood-driving score and thematic-driving score, we went with character-driven score. So every character has their own song and motif, and each of them have their own, like, style and instrument. And that's really what we wanted to push and highlight, and also factor in, you know, because it's comedy, moments of tension and also execution and punchlines and silence. So we could give our sound designers, like Tiago and Denise, a lot of flexibility and ability to create disgusting small sounds throughout, you know, the house or on the street or at Burgers Now. And yeah, working with Peter was incredible because he is such a master at his craft. And we definitely approached it in the opposite direction, where we went with character-driven score as opposed to thematic-driven score.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing. It really stood out for me, as I'm not hearing score. Yes, I will hear score, and then where traditionally people might have score in there for transitions and all of this, you don't do that. And I really thought that that helped punctuate the satiric nature, or shall we say the villainy, of each of our characters. And it was unexpected, but an unexpected pleasure to have the score approached in this method. I mean, really nicely done. Now, I have to ask you, where did you find your production designer? Where did you find Dorothy? Because she does such an amazing job with the production design, and then your set dresser.
So Dorothy was a referral from a lot of good film friends. She was referred multiple times. Our set dresser was Jalen Tan, and our art director, actually, Ash Papachek, they were all hired under Dorothy. And so once we brought Dorothy on board, then Dorothy brought the entire team, which was great. And she and I had such, it was like one in the same, cut from the same cloth kind of perspective on the movie. And we had so many Pinterest and mood boards going, and she gets it.
What led you to your color palette for this film? Because I love the color palette. I love the blues that extend through Kent's walls into Annie and George's house, into the wallpapers, and even some really, I don't know, how do we describe them? Eye-popping or cringing wallpaper designs?
Yeah.
How did you develop your color palette for this film?
Well, Shawnee, Dorothy, and I really talked about the themes of what we wanted the audience to see and feel, and the first word that came to all of our minds was muddy. Like, we wanted them to live in an overcast world where it never, where there's never any sun. We wanted everything to feel muddy, even though there are striking colors. And then in the moments we were going to have striking, uncomfortable colors, like the bedroom, which is a really uncomfortable red, just represent the fact that that's a room that is supposed to be calm and nourishing and a place of rest is a disgusting, vibrant red color, which represents their relationship. So that was a discussion between me, Shawnee, and Dorothy, and we went with the word muddy.
Yeah, it works so well, and the fact that you've tied it all together among the different sets, because even the burger place, it's dark. Dark woods, dark floor, it's dark. So that also helps. It falls into your muddy concept. But for the very eye-popping and sparkling, glittery confetti and party-ish and party things. But now, was this your first feature, Tiffany?
This is my first feature, yes.
That's what I thought. So now, having made it through your first feature, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker with a feature? Because I know you had done 5 or 6 shorts before and some music videos, I think, but getting through a feature, it's a little bit different. So what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker that you can now take forward into your future works?
What I learned about myself as a filmmaker, there are two things. One is the importance of being a great leader. Because as a director, yes, it's your creative vision, but also you are the captain of the ship. It just so happens that the ship belongs to the producer. But you are the captain of that ship, and you are trusted by every single person above the line and below the line to execute at the highest level. Mm-hmm. And two is understanding corporate Hollywood and being able to talk business, because ultimately, you know, with a feature, you want people to see it, you want people to buy it, you want people to rent it, and you want that return on investment. So being able to create something that is also commercially viable and having that conversation with the producers and the EPs to be able to have one foot in the business room, the conference room, and the other foot in the creative room. So those are definitely the two things that I took away from my first feature.
Now, having said that, I'm curious. I just had a similar conversation with Michael Jackman, one of the producers of Conclave, the other day. And we were talking about, you mentioned, you know, commercial viability and creative. How do you find the balance there? Do you even think about, when you're coming up with a story like this, putting it together, do you think about the commercial viability, or are you concentrating at that point solely on the creative?
I would say it's a very 50-50 split. I mean, ultimately, I'm here to make a movie. So what that entails is that you can either make an audience laugh, scream, or cry. Ultimately, those are the things that I want an audience to feel. And that, to me, is what I define as commercial viability. Can you bring those emotions out of an audience? And we went with laugh, obviously, because this is a dark comedy. And throughout the process of the writing and the filmmaking and the post and the sound design and, you know, even through the marketing now in press, is can we keep people entertained? Can we give them a razzle-dazzle? Can we give them a show consistently throughout? And if we can, then yes, that means we have done everything within our power and control to entertain. And to me, entertainment equals commercial viability.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really everything. And it goes hand in hand. Creativity equals entertainment, and entertainment equals commercial viability. So the answer is yes, it is all one giant Venn diagram mixing and muddying with each other. And we always thought about the entertainment factor throughout the entire filmmaking process.
Well, you definitely keep us entertained throughout the film. But then, and we're not going to give away spoilers, But I've got to say, you give us one hell of a payoff. The end of this film is just phenomenal. It is phenomenal.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. It's a funky one. It's like funny, but also Shakespearean and tragic, but also really funny.
But it's a perfect payoff for what you've built up to in the film.
Thank you.
Because yes, you keep us entertained, and you said, yes, you want to keep people entertained, but you know, what's the payoff? And you give us a hell of a payoff here. I didn't see all of that coming, and I loved every second of it when it did. So, job so well done, Tiffany.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate everything that you said.
It
makes my heart full.
Are you working on a new film now?
I am. I can't say what it is.
That's okay. That's okay. No, don't divulge anything like that. We don't want to jinx anything or screw it up. But I'm so glad. And and you're going to do a feature again?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. With what you've done with Trigger Happy, definitely. I want to see more features from you. And, of course, everybody can see Trigger Happy right now because it's out on digital.
Yes.
All the usual suspect places. You can find it. And it's well worth the $6.99 or $9.99 or whatever is being charged for it. You will definitely get that back in the laughs. Sincerely. Tiffany.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining me on Behind the Lens today. I hope you're going to come back on the show again in the future.
Yes, absolutely. This is so fun. I really, really appreciate it. I am so full of gratitude.
Well, I'm just so thrilled that I got to see this film and got to talk to you. Because it is. It's a fun film. It entertains and you get a payoff. And you can't ask for more than that.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you get it.
Thank you so much, Tiffany. And hopefully we'll chat sooner rather than later.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
All right,
bye-bye.
Thank you for everything. Bye.
And that was Tiffany Kim Stevens, director and co-writer of Trigger Happy. It is on digital now. See it. It's a lot of fun. It's dark. Dark comedy. As is Dito Montiel's Riff Raff. It's another dark comedy. And I think we could all use some laughs right now. So, two films to check out. Go to the theater for Riff Raff. Sit at home. Comfort of your couch. Lay on your bed. And watch Trigger Happy. All right. That is all the time we have today. Of course, we ran over back in the studio again. Next week, as I said, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with Adam Egoyan, plus another gem. So until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.